Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The Pentagon has announced the release of a new manual meant to keep interrogators within the bounds of the law. The announcement comes on this week's one-year anniversary of the Abu Ghraib scandal, when photos seen round the world showed U.S. soldiers at Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison laughing, smoking, posing over piles of naked prisoners, and prisoners being tortured. Edward Alden is Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Edward, this new manual that the Army is preparing, it's the first revised one in 13 years, it's called Human Intelligence Collector Operations. What's been reaction?
Well, I mean, there's very little reaction yet. The news is just out this morning. There was some discussion of it at a hearing up on the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing up on the Hill this morning. I think what we see here is we see some new explicit prohibitions on the sort of treatment of detainees that has come to light since the Abu Ghraib scandal first surfaced a year ago. But I think if you look at the old Army manuals, there was never much doubt that those sort of techniques were not permitted. I think the Army has long been very clear that humane treatment of prisoners is required. I think the problem here was never at the level of the Army manual. The problem was at a much higher level.
Now, reportedly, they're going to spell some of them out, prohibiting practices such as stripping prisoners or using police dogs. But as you're saying, the language in previous manuals should have prohibited that. Well, the Army has also called for training of more interrogators and more MPs with expertise in handling prisoners. Your thoughts?
I think that's probably the most important part of this development. I mean, I think one of the things that clearly happened after September 11th is that suddenly there was this tremendous demand to get information out of suspected terrorist detainees because we were, of course, scared of the possibility of another attack, and these people might have information that could help you head off such an attack. The problem was that the Army, there was a paucity of trained interrogators, particularly people with language abilities. So I think there's no question that a lot of people who ended up in situations, a lot of soldiers, military police, who ended up in situations where they were interrogating prisoners had not been adequately trained for that task. And I think there's no question that some of the abuses arose from that lack of training. So I think that is a significant development on this front.
Well, and the issue of accountability is being heard this week. A column by Bob Herbert in the New York Times today is titled, On Abu Ghraib, The Big Shots Walk. Do people you talk to in the military and Congress believe everyone who should be held accountable is being held accountable?
Well, I think there are real divisions. I mean, Senator Rockefeller, who's the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee last week, delivered a rather passionate speech saying, we need a full Senate committee investigation of interrogation techniques, of rendering of what's gone on since Abu Ghraib. The Republican who heads the committee, Senator Pat Roberts, said, no, that's ridiculous. We've had a dozen internal Army investigations. This has been very seriously vetted by the Army, which I think is true. I mean, I think the only reason the Abu Ghraib photos came to light was because the Army investigated itself very aggressively. What we haven't had, and what Bob Herbert's column, I think, pointed out rightly, is we haven't had an independent outside investigation. We haven't had the sort of thing that happened after September 11th. It's kind of as if we'd responded to September 11th by saying to the FBI and the CIA, you go and investigate yourself, find out what you did wrong, and we'll accept that as the final word. That's essentially what's happened here. The Army has investigated itself, and that's the final word.
Meanwhile, isn't this a sort of a slippery slope? In the seconds we have left, the Army officials have said they want to tell people about, for instance, the new manual, but at the same time, they don't want to alert future detainees, captives, of what to expect, because that's the key to interrogation.
Well, I think there's no question you don't want to be precise about exactly what sort of interrogation techniques you're going to use, but there's a long-standing prohibition that this will just reiterate, which is those techniques can't include the whole range of abuses that we've seen come to light. Mm-hmm. So I think lots of people in the military and outside have said the U.S. needs to make absolutely clear that however clever and effective we need to be in interrogations, these kinds of techniques have to be forbidden, absolutely, and I think this will probably help clarify that.
Edward Alden, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, thank you.
Thanks very much, Robert.
This Saturday, in what's now called Ho Chi Minh City, there will be a celebration marking the collapse of the South Vietnamese government, marked by the fall of Saigon, a defeat seared in the memory of all Americans who watched on television as U.S. Embassy officials frantically retreated in helicopters from the roof of the U.S. Embassy, leaving thousands of desperate South Vietnamese behind. Sound recorded by CBS News 30 years ago at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. It was thought the city could hold off a while longer, but the North Vietnamese marched swiftly through Hue and Da Nang, and suddenly they were on Saigon's doorstep. Terry Bennington was a 20-year-old Marine sergeant based at that embassy 30 years ago. He's on the line with us now. Sergeant Major, what was your job exactly?
My responsibility at the American Embassy at that time was running the rooftop evacuation site where we brought CH-46 helicopters onto the roof. We were taking evacuees, Vietnamese and Americans and foreign nationals, and putting them out through the roof on CH-46s out to the South China Sea.
But you couldn't take them all. Can you describe that incredible scene?
Well, the thing about it is that is really unique that I'm 52 years old and will never forget the ladder well that we used to bring the evacuees up was not a very large ladder well, so of course people were packed in there pretty tight. The last thing that really I think affected me and I will probably never forget will be the people that were packed into that stairwell and we had to close the door and we couldn't take them with us and we left them in that ladder well there and they couldn't get out of the ladder well because there were so many people in it that they couldn't go backwards. So that's probably the most devastating portion of my part in the evacuation I will probably never forget.
Yeah. There were thousands of people trying to be evacuated, and that's in the ladder well. But outside the compound, you did some guard work there as well when these people were pressing up against the big wrought iron fence. It still stands there.
Well, what transpired one event there was Ambassador Martin determined that he wanted to walk from the American Embassy back to his quarters, which was probably 8-9 blocks away from the American Embassy, and he determined that he wanted to go out those gates. So what we attempted to do was we put, I think, about 10, 11 Marines outside the gate and tried to expand to get the people away from the gate so we could open it and he could get through. But unfortunately, there were so many that there was no way that we were ever going to get the gate open. There were a lot of Arvin soldiers that were armed that were there, a lot of deserters. Of course, there were a lot of NVA that were still in the area.
NVA?
NVA, which was the Vietnamese Army, North Vietnamese Army. So there was no way that we were ever going to get that gate open. So needless to say, Ambassador Martin did not get out through the compound that way.
I remember those pictures. And in the meantime, some of the people you did have to bring over and through that fence. How'd you do that?
Well, in a lot of cases, what transpired is our detachment at the beginning of this thing was only about 40 Marines. They split our detachment in half and sent 20 of the Marines out to the DAO complex out by Tonsonut Air Base, so we were down to 20 Marines. As the people started to come to the American Embassy, there were so many of them, there was no way that 20 Marines were going to hold them off. Of course, we had a lot of consular staff and embassy staff that were assisting, but they were still getting over the walls. Even though there was barbed wire and on top of the walls there was a glass embedded in the concrete, they were still coming over. Fortunately, the compound was divided out, so we were able to keep them outside of the American Embassy compound and inside a recreational compound. The most amazing sight was when the evacuation was completed at Tonsonut Air Base at the DOA out there. They brought in two CH-53s with infantry Marines on it to help us expand that perimeter back out so we were able to get control of the American Embassy. So we took the outside grunts, which is what we call them, infantry Marines that came from the 7th Fleet, and we had them man the walls. And those guys, in most cases, had a difficult job because they were the ones that had to keep them off the walls. And the embassy Marines, which I was part of, was assisting. And if an American would come up to the wall or a Vietnamese or a foreign national that we wanted to take out, we literally would reach over the wall, in some cases grab them by the head of their hair and pull them up over the walls. And then, of course, at the same time, you've got other Vietnamese that are trying to get into the compound, so you've got to knock them off. So the bottom line is it got pretty hectic there for a while.
Oh, and these had been, in most cases, your allies.
Well, and you know, the sad part about it is that it wasn't, there were families, you know, with their children in their arms, begging to be taken out, but they're, you know, we couldn't take them. I mean, that's the bottom line. Yeah. The sad part is a lot of these people would offer you all their life savings, their money. In some cases, there were offers of gold and diamonds and things like that to get them over the wall, and we couldn't do it.
What happened when you had to leave the compound walls? I mean, at a certain point, it was sort of, okay, this is not working. We are in full evacuation mode. You had to leave those compound walls and think of yourselves and retreating. What happened?
Well, what had transpired is a CH-46 landed on the roof, and there was a pilot by the name of Jerry Berry, who was a retired Marine colonel, was the pilot. When he landed on the roof, he motioned to me, and he wasn't taking any of our evacuees, so there was a phone on the helicopter that I went over and picked up. And Berry told me that he had a presidential order. This helicopter was for Ambassador Martin. So I immediately went down to Ambassador Martin's office and relayed the information to him that the helicopter on the roof is for him, and there was a presidential order, and he refused that order. So I went back up to the helipad, explained to Captain Berry what transpired, and we loaded up his helicopter with evacuees, and he left. Well, about an hour later, he came back with a second presidential order. So at that time, what I did was I called Jim Keene, who was a captain, was my CO, and told him what was going on, and he met me in the ambassador's office, and he told the ambassador that, you know, he cannot refuse this presidential order, and it seems like at that very moment is when he realized it was over. So we got him up to the roof, we gave him the American flag, put him on a helicopter, and he left. Then we started to tone down the flight operations, and we concentrated only on foreign nationals and Americans.
I just want to hold you up there, Sergeant Major. You know, you're handing over the flag. That's an important moment.
Oh, very important moment, a very significant moment. The people knew that once the flag come down that it was over, and we were very careful how we did everything. Mm. Well, once we got Ambassador Martin on the helicopter and gone, the whole tempo of the operation changed at that time. We had approximately 100 Marines in the compound total. So what we did was we had to get all the Marines inside the American embassy and up to the roof. One scene that I will never forget, and I'm pretty sure it was a Navy CB that was with us. As we were backing into the embassy, the crowd started to rush. This guy picked up a huge, huge board and started swinging it just to keep the people off until we could get into the American embassy. Mm. Once we got into the embassy, they had these huge doors, and we closed it and we barred it, and we started going to the roof. Well, we had left a fire engine in the compound, and what they did was they got in the fire engine and drove it through the door. Mm. So now those Marines have a mad run to get to the roof ahead of these people. So once we got them onto the roof and in, we secured, there was only one door that you could get in. We secured that door, and we barricaded it, and we trapped those people in the ladder well so they couldn't get to us.
Sergeant Major Terry Bennington, hold it right there. We want to continue this story, his story of the final days of Saigon as he saw it from the roof of the U.S. Embassy as a 22-year-old 30 years ago. We'll have more, much more, coming up here and now. Yesterday, we spoke with a Vietnamese man in Da Nang who tried and failed to get out of Vietnam when Saigon fell. Today, we've been speaking with Terry Bennington. He was a 22-year-old Marine based at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in 1975. He desperately tried to get at least some South Vietnamese out and then realized he had to rescue himself. Sergeant Major, you were telling us that you were at the embassy holding back crowds. You have now, in your story, managed to get the Marines that are left up to the roof. You've secured the door leading up there so that no one else can get out on the roof. Now the helicopters coming in were dedicated to getting the remaining Marines out. And finally, there were only 11 of you left. So what happened then?
For some reason, there was a miscommunication in Washington, D.C., that when Ambassador Martin left, there was a code word that they passed. And Washington assumed it was over and said, shut it down. Well, the pilots had been flying for a very, very long time, well beyond the time they were probably supposed to. So they shut flight operations down. So the 11 Marines were still on the roof. Mm-hmm. And while we were on the roof, we were able to watch the people that were in our compound. They just started tearing the place apart. I mean, they started stealing everything, you know, the furniture, the refrigerators, the air conditioners. And if they couldn't get into a building, they would literally rip the roof off and go in through the roof. It was unbelievable.
Well, and here you are. You're stuck on the roof. It's the dead of night. The thousands of desperate South Vietnamese, again, former allies, just steps away from you, but blocked by a door and disabled elevators. What are you thinking?
Well, to be honest with you, we had confidence that, you know, they wouldn't leave us. But, you know, after about three and a half hours go by, you know, you start to have second thoughts. So it was discussed that what we would consider doing was the 11 Marines would climb down the rocket screen. The embassy was encased with a rocket screen that if somebody fired a rocket, it would explode on the outside rocket screen. But there was a space in between that and the embassy that we could have climbed down. So we had discussed perhaps climbing down and all of us trying to make it to the South China Sea, confiscating a vessel and making our own way out to the fleet. But probably was a good thing that we did not do that simply because the NVA by that time had already mustered and we could see them off in the distance.
So you could see the Viet Cong?
Oh, yes. Oh, they were hitting Thanh Nguyen Air Base pretty hard.
So you're on the roof,
yes.
Desperate South Vietnamese below you, thousands of them, and ringing the city, the Viet Cong, and you could see them coming in. It sounds insane.
Well, we had determined, though, that one thing we were not going to do is we were not going to give up. We were not going to surrender to them. So what we determined to do was stay where we were just a little bit longer. And if things didn't come to fruition, a helicopter come get us, then we were going to go down the wall and try to make it to the South China Sea. Yeah. But off in the distance, probably about 30 minutes later, we could see a speck out there, and it was a helicopter. But we had to be careful because you had to realize that South Vietnamese that were defecting were also flying CH-46 helicopters. So we didn't know if it was a good guy or a bad guy. Mm. But and we had no radio communication. By that time, our radios, the batteries were dead. But we had plenty of weapons on that roof. I mean, we had enough weapons to start a pretty good-sized firefight. Mm. But as the helicopter came in, we realized it was an American helicopter. He came in, he sat down. Needless to say, we very quickly got on that helicopter. The last person to put his foot on that helicopter is a retired master gunnery sergeant by the name of Juan Valdez. We had determined before we would run for the bird that we would take all the CS gas and smoke that we had and we would throw it. So that's what we did. So as we're sitting on the helicopter, he didn't take off right away, and the turbines of the engine started to suck in that CS gas.
Because you were going to try to do a smoke screen for your escape, but he didn't escape.
Yeah, but once he realized we had gassed ourselves, because we had we got rid of all of our gear except for our weapons to get more people on the helicopters. And once he realized we had gassed ourselves, he took off pretty quick.
Sergeant Major Terry Bennington, you and Juan Valdez and nine others, the last men out of the U.S. Embassy as Saigon falls.
Yes, ma'am.
What were your thoughts leaving behind people you thought you were going to help?
Well, you know, at that time, it's a lot of sadness. You know, an awful lot of Americans died in that war. But I got to tell you, as I look back over the years, some amazing things have happened. I'll give you a good example. 5 years ago, I got a call from a captain in the Marine Corps, and he said, "You're not going to believe this," because there was some news, press, and all that good stuff about the 25th year. And he was a captain in the Marine Corps, and we had put his family on a helicopter. We got him out. So when you realize that we brought so many people from Vietnam to this country, and today they have produced generation of children that haven't seen war, they've got an education, they're Americans now. And also when I look back over the years, because I am still working for the Marine Corps as a civilian, what Vietnam did was transformed our mindset in the military of how we train Marines. And a good example is the performance of our Marines today in Iraq. They are performing magnificently, and the reason they're doing that is because we learned from Vietnam. We learned our lessons, and we learned them well.
And the lesson being?
The lesson being that we've got to train our personnel. We've got to let military people fight the war. Civilians should never, ever, ever have to give us permission to drop artillery and aircraft bombs and things like that on enemy targets. That was crazy.
Well, Sergeant Major Terry Bennington, you know, history will long debate Vietnam and other military actions. But, you know, staying with this day, the anniversary, you speak as if every single detail of that exit from the embassy is fresh in your mind as it was 30 years ago. Do you still think about it? I mean, I know there are some of you who still gather.
It had an impact on me that I will never, ever forget. But the faces, the people. And I've been back to Vietnam. I went back to Vietnam in 1994. And it was hard to go back there because sometimes, you know, you look at someone and you say, well, are you one that we forgot? Are you one that we left? I also think about the good part about it, the amount of Vietnamese that were friendly to us that we got out of that country. And, you know, we did a lot of good. We really did a lot of good. And when I look at it from that perspective, I realize that we can't fix everything, but we sure fixed a lot there at the end. And we brought a lot of people out and saved a lot of lives.
Sergeant Major Terry Bennington is a retired Marine. He was a sergeant at the time of the evacuation of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon and was one of the 11 men on the roof waiting for the very last helicopter to leave Saigon. Sergeant Major, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
And for more on the last group of Marines out of Saigon 30 years ago this week, go to our website, here-now.org. More ahead here and now. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says the U.S. will stick with a program to eradicate the coca plants in Colombia that are the source of much of the cocaine and heroin in the U.S., even though the $3 billion program showed disappointing results last year. On her five-day swing through Latin America, Rice is promoting free trade, security, and democracy, and playing down concerns about leftist leader Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, who controls a major source of U.S. oil. Well, joining us on the line from Miami is Professor Bruce Bagley, who teaches international relations at the University of Miami. Professor, how is this trip being perceived by Latin Americans?
Well, I would say that they were pleased to have an opportunity to get to know the new Secretary of State, but that the reception was at very best lukewarm. There is a growing divergence between the policy priorities of the United States and those of many Latin American countries, and it was evident throughout her trip.
Well, and she noted, for instance, in Brazil, the huge poverty in that country and urged them, Brazilians, to not lose hope, not lose courage, stick with democracy. Just a quick thought from you on Rice's language in Brazil seemed to conflate religion and democracy. She said, in time, the blessings of democracy come to everyone who keeps the faith with the principles of democracy. Is that typical talk for diplomats?
No, I don't think so, although it certainly fits in with the Bush administration and the tone of faith-based diplomacy that we have seen. The facts of the matter are that Brazil has major developmental challenges. Brazil is an important stumbling block to the free trade area of the Americas. They want to see a reduction in U.S. Agricultural subsidies because that's where they can compete. And unless the United States comes through on that, all of the preaching in the world is not going to convince them that U.S. priorities are the same as theirs.
Right. Well, you are a Colombia specialist. The U.S. is helping the Colombian government put down three insurgencies, in part through this coca eradication program called Plan Colombia. And yet U.S. officials are disappointed that cultivation hasn't changed since 2003.
Well, the drugs are cheaper, more readily available, and more pure in the United States today than they were when Plan Colombia started. The facts of the matter are that Plan Colombia has not worked. And one of the key reasons is that we insist on aerial spraying or fumigation, when in fact what we need is manual eradication. Unless we are able to address the problems of the peasantry that is displaced by aerial spraying, they simply keep replanting and keep growing coca illegally in Colombia.
And others are agreeing with you that the plants should be pulled out by hand as opposed to sprayed. By the way, how do Colombians feel about the herbicide known in this country as Roundup,
It's actually known as Roundup Ultra, which is an added on to the actual Roundup distributed by Monsanto. The Colombians are quite divided. The government has supported it, but it does important ecological damage throughout the headwaters of the Amazon. It not only kills coca, but it kills subsistence crops. It can also kill chickens, dogs. It can affect children, causing rashes. So there is a great deal of distress in southern Colombia over this program of aerial spraying. In fact, six governors last year protested against their own government's approval of U.S. spraying. And frankly, it simply is not working. Increasingly, we're seeing even U.S. authorities recognizing that.
We should point out that Monsanto claims that the herbicide doesn't leave any residue, but many, including the Attorney General of New York, have challenged that claim. But those are the topics on the table as Secretary Rice visits Colombia. But some say overshadowing the whole trip is a country she's not visiting, Venezuela, and concerns about Hugo Chavez and Venezuela's oil exports to the U.S. Your thoughts?
Well, there's no question that Chavez and Venezuela are concerns of Secretary of State Rice and the United States. Chavez's anti-democratic tendencies, his anti-U.S. rhetoric, his expulsion recently of American troops, all indicate that Chavez is moving in a very anti-American direction. So the United States has a variety of reasons to be concerned about Chavez. But the other countries in Latin America, Brazil, where Condoleezza Rice has already been, and Chile, where she's going after Colombia, have both expressed concern that the United States is going to seek to isolate a democratically elected government, and they do not want to participate in that kind of isolation of another Latin American leader. They, in fact, worry that the United States could then turn on them at some point in the future.
Bruce Bagley, Professor of International Relations at the University of Miami. Professor, thank you.
My pleasure.
The giant ivory-billed woodpecker has eluded birdwatchers and scientists for over 60 years. It was thought extinct. But now scientists have confirmed that the woodpecker is alive and well and pecking away in Arkansas. Joining us in the studio for the latest is science reporter Alan Cockle. Alan, can you describe this bird for us? Because I understand it is quite large.
Hi, Robin. Large and beautiful. Teddy Roosevelt, among others, called it the Lord God bird because when people saw it, they would fall to their knees and say, Lord God, what a bird.
Really?
It looks a lot like the pileated woodpecker, which some people will know, a large black woodpecker with a flaming red crest on its head and white stripes running down the neck. The ivory billed is similar, but it's bigger. The male has that same red crest. The female has a black crest. The white stripes run down the neck and join together to give it a flashing white rump. And, of course, it has that ivory bill. Pileated has a black bill. The ivory has this long, beautiful, tapering, ivory-colored bill. It's a stunning bird.
Well, and so how big is this news for scientists and birders?
It's huge. It's hard to imagine any other North American bird that it would be more exciting to rediscover. The lists of, you know, the internet lists of birders are just buzzing. And there was a press conference this morning, and I think you can hear, this is John Fitzpatrick, who led the search for the bird. He's the director of the Cornell University Bird Lab, and I think you can hear the excitement in his voice.
I can't begin to tell you how thrilling it is. As a proud American, humbly privileged to announce that after 60 years of fading hopes that we would ever see this spectacular bird again.
They have seen it, and they have video, 3 seconds worth, so they know they have the right thing. But does this mean that the ivory-billed woodpecker is here to stay?
Well, that's a good question. We have to say clearly that they, as far as they know, have only seen one bird. Is this some last lonely old male who's out there living a lonely life in the big woods of eastern Arkansas? Or are there breeding pairs? The USDA announced several million dollars today to save the habitat to plant new trees, but it remains to be seen whether the bird can be saved.
And Alan, in the few seconds we have, what happened here? Were scientists wrong in saying the bird was extinct, or what happened? I mean, obviously they were wrong, but...
Well, the bird was on and off the list for years. There were always these tantalizing reports of people who thought they saw it, but it could never be proven. And so now they say they have definitive evidence. It's this 3 seconds of grainy video. It looks a bit like the Sasquatch footage from the late 60s with the bird disappearing into the forest. But they've analyzed it, and they can see those white feathers very clearly. So they say, this is it.
Perhaps Bigfoot could be next.
Maybe.
Science reporter Alan Cockle. Alan, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now. This month, writer Matt Crossman traveled from his home in St. Louis to the Bristol Motor Speedway in Tennessee to attend NASCAR's wildly popular Food City 500 to see what it would be like to spend the entire weekend using only NASCAR-associated products, including gas, food, lodging, transportation, clothing, toothbrushes, and deodorant. He chronicled his total immersion weekend in a recent article in the Sporting News. Only a Game's Bill Littlefield spoke to him and asked Crossman to describe the difference between total NASCAR existence and non-NASCAR existence.
Well, it's really not that big of a difference. I mean, I wore Levi's, I wore Fruit of the Loom, I wore golf shirts, I ate at McDonald's, I ate at Subway, I drove a Ford, I drove a Monte Carlo. One of the points I hope to make in the piece is, you know, NASCAR for a long time was just beer, tobacco, and automotive products, and it's clearly way beyond that now.
So NASCAR is so thoroughly sponsored, you can do anything and be associated with NASCAR.
Yeah, the old saying used to be that there were two kinds of NASCAR fans, a skull-dipping, bud-drinking mechanic and her husband. And I think what I hope to prove this weekend was that if that was ever true, it's utterly untrue now.
According to NASCAR, its average fan spends $700 a year on NASCAR tickets and merchandise. According to a survey of 1,000 fans by the James Madison University Center for Sports Sponsorship, 36% correctly identified the primary sponsors for the top 30 Nextel Cup drivers. How has NASCAR managed to connect with its fans the way it has?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with fans connecting with drivers. I mean, the old saying in North Carolina was they taught kids to count 1, 2, Earnhardt, 4, 5, Mark Martin, 7, 8. So I think a lot of it has to do with connecting with the drivers. And then NASCAR also says that NASCAR fans are 3 times more likely to buy a sponsored product over a non-sponsored product. That, to me, it's stunning. You know, it's like I want to create Matt Crossman magazine and put NASCAR's logo on it, and I'd take it right to the bank.
Not so long ago, as you mentioned, NASCAR was almost solely sponsored by beer or cigarettes or companies making something having to do with the automobile. What accounts for the fact that NASCAR now enjoys associations with virtually everything?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you have to trace it back to the mid-1980s when Tide first came in. They weren't the first product that was outside of that realm, but they were, you know, at the risk of sounding sexist, the first product geared toward women. And I realize that's skating on a little bit of thin ice.
Well, I can hear the cracking of the ice,
yeah,
and the emails about to pour in.
It's M. Crossman at, no, I'm just kidding. But then it went on from there, and really it has a lot to do with sponsors seeing NASCAR's figures that there are 75 million fans, 10 million fans watch every race. And you put your name on the side of a car, that's 10 million people seeing the name of that product. Mm-hmm. I think guys who make marketing decisions just see dollar signs.
Now, Matt, I want to confirm the veracity of one anecdote in your Sporting News article. You talked about one young woman whose allegiance to the particular soft drink that was a NASCAR sponsor was so intense that when she went into a diner, if they didn't have it, she would order water.
Absolutely.
Is this true?
It absolutely is. She is a Jeff Gordon fan. She lives in Jacksonville, Florida. And every time I write a NASCAR story, she emails me pleasantly just to discuss NASCAR. And when I started to write this story, I sent her an email that said, you know, do you buy products because of Jeff Gordon? And that was her response. And then to further make her point, she said that when she fills up her gas tank at a gas station, she rounds off at 24 cents, which is Jeff Gordon's car number. So $7.24, $8.24. And since this story has come out, I've gotten at least a dozen emails that say, you know, big deal, you did it for one weekend, I do it all the time. I got an email from a woman this morning who is a Kevin Harvick fan, and one of his sponsors is Sylvania, a light bulb company, mm-hmm. and that's the only light bulb she has in her house. There are so many products in NASCAR, and I don't think a normal fan could name a single official anything of, like, Major League Baseball, yet NASCAR fans, you know, at approaching 50% can name in 9 categories the official product of NASCAR. Marketing students just drool over numbers like that.
Matt Crossman writes for The Sporting News. He spoke with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Classical violinist Catherine Girardot decided recently to take out her violin and explore the world of bluegrass fiddling. She'd always wanted to be able to sit down with strangers and jam, so she decided to take a class called Jamming 101, and that turned out to be a very humbling experience. This postcard from Girardot starts with some advice from her friends.
Listening, looking for the eye contact.
Stay as close to the melody as you can because you have a responsibility to keep the train wreck from happening.
When it's your turn, don't be nervous, just go for it.
They will forgive you all the etiquette rules and help you through.
Always remember, it's about having a good time. You just gotta get out there and do it.
Well, good morning and welcome to Jamming 101, the second installment. For those of you at your first class, it's going to be really slow and really mellow.
Sid Lewis was the answer to my prayers. His class, Jamming 101, was kind of a group therapy session for beginning jammers.
A lot of people seem to think that jamming consists of a bunch of hotshots playing really fast and flashy, and that's the first misnotion I'm trying to dispel here. If you know a couple chords and you have a good attitude about it and you're willing to keep an open mind and learn on your feet, then anyone can jump in a jam circle, anyone.
Sid calls himself the inventor of the 5 levels of jamming.
Level 1 is sitting and smiling.
I can do that.
If you don't know what the heck's going on, you can still be part of the jam and sit there and smile.
Level 2, rhythm. So we're going to warm up today with everybody on this offbeat. We're going to live on the ka of the polka. Polka, polka. What's that?
Number 3 would be where you actually learn the chord progression of a song. Level 4 is where you start to learn the melody and the chords.
2, G chords at the ready, G. Not the one on the board. Back to G. That's all it does.
This is no place for a perfectionist, but my friend's advice kept playing in my head.
It's your turn. Go for it. Don't be nervous. Back. Just go for it.
Fiddle players. Fiddle section.
You know, don't panic. Don't bolt. Don't freak out. You know, it's just music. You can't break your arm. It's not a high-contact sport.
My experience of when it was my turn to play a solo, I, like...
The panic?
I played, but I couldn't, like, remember what I played.
No, that's
it was almost like I
factor.
couldn't... it's like I was not present in my body.
That's natural, that we all have out-of-body experiences in jams, and... The secret with that is repetition. Other jam survival tips. You got to put some flight time in. You got to get a couple hundred jams under your belt. There's no other way to get over that feeling. You just got to, you have to subject yourself to that long enough where it kind of gets faded after a while.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Somehow, I knew this wasn't going to be easy. I remembered when I'd spent a year in Germany in college. After a few months, I'd learned enough German to sit around a dinner table and follow the conversation. But when someone asked me a question, I was tongue-tied. I felt like a 3-year-old in a grown-up's body. I could understand the language when I heard it, but I still couldn't express myself. That's how I felt after Jamming 101. I could kind of follow the structure of a bluegrass song, but there was only one way I was going to learn this new language. I had to swallow my pride and let myself be a beginner again. I had to sit in on a jam.
Catherine, this is Catherine.
Hi, Catherine. You're Catherine?
Yeah.
So there's this cafe in my neighborhood that has a bluegrass jam a couple Sundays a month. I decided to check it out.
I hope I don't hold you guys back, but I really want to learn, so...
I was really nervous. I got there early. At first, it was just me and a fiddle player named Ed. Ed told me he'd been playing for 40 years. He looked like he'd just stepped off a back porch somewhere, where people jam all day long to the drone of cicadas.
No, but it's really about rhythm.
You know, I didn't have to tell him I was a classical player. My velvet-lined violin case was the only clue he needed. I almost hoped he'd say, "Sorry, this is a closed jam," and send me home. Instead, he pulled his chair closer and asked me to play him a tune. "What have you got?" he said. "What have you got?"
I have to. I'm having a blank. A blank. I need to remember how old Joe Clark was. That's right. Okay. Thanks.
Pretty soon, a banjo player showed up, then a guitar, then a mandolin, then another banjo. They all knew each other, but didn't seem to mind me. You can hear me in there. I'm the one who doesn't sound like a fiddler. I'm watching Ed's hands for dear life, wishing my fingers were as quick as my ears to pick up the gesture, the nuance, the groove. The white hairs of his bow are flashing out the rhythm in Morse code, but it feels like there's a split-second delay in my receiver. I'm really out of my depth here. My usual reference points are gone. No music to read, no conductor. My violin strings are tuned to notes they've never been tuned to before. But I'm riding it, riding that wave of sound. I'm catching the chord changes. I'm hearing those banjos on the offbeats. I'm sticking to the melody, and it feels great. Ed said he'd teach me some tunes if I came to the jam next time. I don't know if I will or not. I have to admit, I still don't love bluegrass music. I won't be sorry if I don't hear old Joe Clark again for a while. But I still can't quite believe I sat down with a group of total strangers in a cafe and made music.
That postcard comes from classical violinist Catherine Girardot, who decided to try her hand at bluegrass fiddle playing. Visiting the world of bluegrass, here's a taste from a master, banjoist Allison Brown. Her new CD is due out in May. It's called Stolen Moments. The song is called The Magnificent Seven. We'll have a conversation with Allison in the coming weeks. Is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Ann Stevenson. Our interns, Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.